Our fourth speaker is David Patterson. David taught history at King Edward VI College, Nuneaton, for 33 years before retiring just 5 years ago. Since the late 1970s, he has been researching into local political, religious, and ecclesiastical history. He has written for Warwickshire History, you could see copies downstairs of that, old issues of that, and The Historian. And he co-authored A History of Nuneaton Parish Church, 1985, and he has written a history of his own school, the school where he taught history, Edward VI School, Leek's Legacy, which was published last year. And the talk this afternoon is about that. Its title is Parishioners and Pupils, an Endowed Grammar School and its Local Parish in the 16th Century.
Thank you. I'm going to divide this into two parts, the setting up of the school, and then how far was the school really a parochial institution, and how far should education be focused more when we look at parish studies? Well, the establishment and early history of Nuneaton's first school, shows, I think, some initiative by the parishioners of the town. That's what I'm going to argue, but I'll welcome comments at the end if we have time. Having seen Nuneaton's history flash past with Mark Booth's presentation in 20 seconds, I'm going to talk for 20 minutes about one particular aspect of it. The school, which is known as King Edward VI School, so those of you who are good with dates will be surprised that it was set up, I think, in 1540. So it predates Edward VI. It was an early response to the Reformation tendency to favour education, of boys anyway, over prayers for the deceased, favouring the living over the dead, the young over grieving relatives. Chantries set up in the late 15th, early 16th centuries were increasingly ones that involved educational provision, and as such were often the result of an individual or small group initiative rather than that of the parish. When chantries were closed in 1547, it's true that schools may well have been set up with some of their money. Although it's a confused period, much educational provision was lost, at least temporarily. Historians still argue about how much the closing of chantries affected education. There was certainly some delay, children must have been affected. But the story of Nuneaton, as so often I'm sure people find when they look at their own region, doesn't quite fit the pattern. It's more interesting, I think. This is part of St Nicholas Church, Nuneaton. It's called, originally, the Lady Chapel, but then called the Leek Chapel, which it still is. And it's got two additional pairs of higher windows because it was made into a chantry. The chapel was enlarged to accommodate the chantry prayers of John Leek and his family. But after the closure of Nuneaton Priory in September 1539, parishioners did a bit of anticipating. They decided that perhaps the days of the chantries were numbered if monasteries had gone. And Leek's chantry was closed and a grammar school established, I think, in about 1540, but that's another lecture. So it's a comparatively early switch of function, although it's not unique by any means. A lot of chantries were closed in anticipation. It's an interesting example, I think, of a parochial initiative. Leek's will had a conditional clause in it when he set up the chantry. He wanted prayers for his soul if they can be enjoyed without interruption by the king. Otherwise, he wished them to be the money to be distributed to the poor in works of charity. Now, this is a very unusual form of wording for 1508. And people used to think, did he anticipate the Reformation? But I think it's simply that in the last 3 years of Henry VII's reign, he was so money-grabbing that he was frequently refusing licenses, the licenses in Mortmain, the Dead Hand, whereby the money would be gift-aided, we might say, by the person who set up the chantry. The money would escape the taxman and be safely in the hands of the chantry priest. And so he anticipated that it might not be granted, but it was, the wording remained in. But he never actually gave it for a school. And they used that wording to justify a free school, because that would be for the poor. So the Leake family connection, but by 1540, was fairly limited in Nuneaton. He owned property roundabout, but didn't really have much connection with Nuneaton. And I think given that, and the tenor of the times, perhaps the feeling that the days of chances were numbered, Leake's relatives don't seem to have been consulted, or they privately agreed. The chantry was closed and a school was set up. So who were these people who thought that the town would benefit more from education than from prayers for the dead? Could it have been a parochial initiative? With the closing of Nuneaton Priory, 1539, and the nearby Arbury Priory is a smaller one in 1536, one of the main sources of economic activity in the town was over. And what would replace it? It had been the priory's development in the 12th century that helped to develop Nuneaton into a small market town, establish it as a parish in its own right, and the priory had effectively been lord of the manor. And on its dissolution, their estates were granted to Sir Marmaduke Constable, who wasn't local at all, but a member of a distinguished Yorkshire family, an outsider. And he soon produced an inventory of his possessions, which is very useful for historians, and I'll come back to it. But the rapid change from chantry to school, with the aid of Leake's legacy, the money John Leake left, does, I think, suggest a parochial initiative. The income was very small. Leake only left, because he diversified his giving to many other causes, £4, £3.66, barely enough to keep a schoolmaster. But the school survived, although we have little evidence of its early fortunes before 1552. So I'm going to argue it's a parochial initiative. What are the alternatives? Well, I suppose one alternative is dear old Sir Marmaduke, who is buried in Nuneaton Parish Church. But I suspect that his heart's there, literally his heart metaphorically was in Yorkshire, where the family was from. And I discovered he was in debt. He'd lost the Yorkshire estates because of the execution of his father in the Pilgrimage of Grace in 1536. I don't think he was in a position to invest in a school. In fact, I found out from the accounts that he borrowed from the governors because his widow had to try and repay the money. So I don't think it was him. Could it have been the incumbent, the vicar of Nuneaton? Well, that at first looks more promising, because Robert Whittington, who had been vicar since 1521, was a keen scholar of the classics. He's a writer, educationalist, translator, closely involved with education, and even educating people at court. Had strong views on the teaching of Latin. But he didn't spend much time in Nuneaton. He's a pluralist. And there's only one reference to him living at the vicarage. And it's not a very happy one for him, because it's a legal case accusing him of fornication and continence with one Marjorie Wade, who admitted living with him there in 1525. That seems to be the only thing that he did in the vicarage, because as far as we can see, she actually admits to travelling round with him as a kind of common law wife. So however much revisionists say, there is some scandal in the pre-Reformation church. And I think, therefore, it's likely that he wasn't, although interested in education, I don't think he's really liked to be involved. I think it could well be the parishioners. And we had a reference to this in one of the other sessions I went to about Ethan Chagan saying ordinary people can be seen to play a part in the Reformation. And this idea that the change to a school comes not so much from strong Protestant feeling as a pragmatic sense of the possible. They might get their clutches on this chantry. Let's use it for what we want now. So because of that early initiative, Nuneaton's parishioners, if my suspicions are correct, the school survived the Chantry Commissioner's visit in 1548 when they were instructed to confiscate all property and income relating to a chantry within the last 6 years. But they'd beaten them to it. And it's likely to have been something like 8 years. So the school got away with it, it continued. But it's financially very, very tight. But we know that the Edwardian commissioners who were starting in 1551, 1552, early 1553, coming round, taking what they could out of the parish churches to finance wars and other well-known ecclesiastical causes, found, as in other places, the Nuneaton parishioners got in first, and they had been busy selling church plate. But unlike some places which were lining their own pockets with this money, selling the church goods quickly before the commissioners got in, Nuneaton said, "We've set up a school." So they're one of the goodies, if you like. Again, not unique, but interesting. And fortunately for them, probably friends in high places, maybe the Duke of Suffolk's the most likely candidate here. In 1552, their financial struggles were eased by the fact that King Edward granted them income from the confiscated lands of the wealthy Coventry guilds of Holy Trinity and Corpus Christi. And that's has set up the school for several hundred years. And a poor parish school had been aided by wealthy funds from elsewhere. It's a good piece of socialism going on here. And an annual income little more than £4 now became over 10. And the Duke of Suffolk, who was very influential, father of Lady Jane Grey, lived nearby Astley, may well have been the person that got them this. There was also the humble petition of the inhabitants of the town of Nuneaton. So the parishioners were doing their best. So do we know who the inhabitants were or who set up the school? Well, in an indirect sort of way. We don't have the records of who set up the school, but a year or two afterwards, Marmaduke Constable made an inventory of his new property in Nuneaton, the Constable rent roll. And from that, I was able to find all 12 original governors of King Edward's. We have the record of them when the Edwardian Foundation was established, the 12 governors. They're all in the Marmaduke Constable rent roll back in 1542. I suspect these are the people that we can say, without absolute proof, were the ones who made the initiative. And you'll see that apart from Sir Marmaduke, it's good yeoman stuff. With the tanner at the bottom because he's smelt. So he's lower orders, definitely. So those are the ones that we had, and some of them remain governors for quite a long time. So the yeomen of the parish are there. To use a modern phrase, the driving seat of educational innovation. I don't think they'd recognise that one, but that's what seems to be happening. Not that they were very well educated themselves, because in 1576, as late as 1576, I think some early ones, they're still making their marks on documents. So some of them are illiterate. And yet, they seem to think education is important for other people. But, of course, being illiterate doesn't mean you haven't got business nous. and they seem to have been very good at business. Maybe you don't need education at all. Perhaps you can just go out and make your money. They'd arranged it, whether this was deliberate or not, the schoolmaster's salary stayed at just over the £10. Somebody's doing okay here. Of course, the school is going to be free. The wording of the original charter says that there is no charge. It's a free school. But that, in effect, I've discovered, really means for people in the parish. There is a distinction in education. People in the parish in endowed schools frequently get the privilege of free education. If you come from outside the parish, you don't get that privilege. The governors were to be other fit persons of the inhabitants of the town and parish. It doesn't say about the boys, but in the Charter of 1694 it says scholars could be charged or rejected if they dwell far out of the town or the parish. It's a little bit vague. But the way the school operated, it looks as if it was just free for people there. Although, the master could accept payments, bribes, fees, you interpret it. But that's what he says. Maybe he took others in, but there's no master's house yet, so borders would be difficult, although there is a reasonable sized vicarage, not as big as today's. How precise was the ruling that boys could only attend freely from inside the parish? Well, it is a little bit vague. We've already heard reference to William Burton this afternoon. He's an old boy of Nuneaton. And his Anatomy of Melancholy blockbuster book, Robert Burton, his brother. And they were pretty fluent in Greek. I mean, they don't have everybody as teenagers writing plays in Greek. So I think they must have got a reasonably good classical education. They actually lived in Leicestershire, because William Burton's associated with Leicestershire. Nuneaton Parish is very strangely placed. And you've got the A5 there, Watling Street, coming up, steaming past Hinckley and Nuneaton. Lidley Lodge is on the A5. It's in Leicestershire, but you look out your front window and there's the Warwickshire countryside. So I don't think even the diocesan county or any other boundary is relevant here. You could walk 2 miles to school, or a mile and a half, no problem if you're keen. And the Burtons were keen. This leads to some difficulty. People from the far end of the parish, we had one of the governors, you may have noticed, lived near the Stocking Ford, which is right over the west side of the parish, would live much further away from the school and get a free education, and people living in Chilvers Coton Parish would be within a few hundred yards of the school, but the parish boundary is very close. And that means the Newdigate family, who were very much involved in Coton, only once do they send a boy to the school, and that's in exceptional circumstances. So the drawing of the parish boundaries does create some difficulties. But it goes on, there's still resistance in the late 19th century to the idea of equalising and having, when fees were introduced, some people still felt boys from the parish should get their rights of a free education. So, we know that a few boys did manage to get to Oxbridge, like the Burton brothers, but probably the very poor don't go, they go out to work, and some of the better off get a private tutor. But there was 1578, Gilbert Willoughby was admitted pensioner at Gonville and Keys, and he's referred to as residing in Nuneaton. Well, actually, his family came from Normanton in Nottinghamshire, but his father had married Anne Rotherham, who was a Nuneaton girl, daughter of the King Edward's governor. So there was a sort of connection. And I was reminded when the Church of England introduced qualifying connection in 2008 for marriages, it struck me that they'd thought of that in the 16th century. You had some link, so you got your son in for the education, even though he wasn't quite living there. Now, I've started to talk about parish boundaries, and of course this leads to this idea of how far was the school subject to outside pressures. How far is it of parochial institution? Obviously, a good number of teachers were recruited from outside the parish, and governors, though, had to be inside. But they often looked outside. They sent, there's accounts of sending people off to Coventry to find a teacher. There's a big overturn of teachers. They just come very briefly and then go off. Nonetheless, although they come from the outside, occasionally you do get a vicar appointed. Nicholas Clayton was appointed schoolmaster and then vicar, gave up the job. Another one, George Downes in the 1580s, took on both jobs. So a close relationship with the parish church, and the church and the school are close together, within quite a small distance of each other, though not quite as close as now, but the old grammar school, 1696, right by the church. They would raise funds, they would administer lands, of course, outside the parish. They'd have to go to Coventry to deal with the Corpus Christi and Holy Trinity lands. So there are some outside pressures. But they manage the land shrewdly enough, and they get other people to give them more money for the school. Thomas Daigle was the deposed prior of Arbury Priory, obviously well disposed, and leaves money for them. Some, like John Wheatley, give money to various places in Coventry. But I think the administration of the money was essentially parochial affair. Capital was accumulating rapidly. In fact, they had so much they gave it out to 44 different inhabitants of the parish. Don't spend it on the school or the schoolmaster. Make the parish rich. Well, it's very easy to give it out, but when they suddenly want to build a new school, 1596, and get it back, it wasn't so easy. And there were one or two threats of lawsuits. But because there's no college or corporation involved, you get the feeling the parish are running this. Now, there are other external pressures. There's national, political, religious pressures and uncertainties. They're imposed a William Lilly's standard grammar, not Robert Whittington's, ironically the vicar of Nuneaton, who had a Latin rivalry about how it should be taught. So you get told you've got to do this. You've obviously got religious uniformity. There are certain impositions from outside the parish. And effective control of the schools, though, varied from diocese to diocese. And neither the Bishop of Coventry, the usually conscientious Thomas Bentham, nor his Archdeacon Thomas Lever, although very interested in education, observed the formalities very much about looking after the school. In fact, in the 1580s, Bishop Beverton complained of an untowardness in religion in divers young gentlemen, which doth argue a manifold and most intolerant corruption in schoolmasters. And the religious uncertainties of the mid-century, I think, meant a lowering of the number of ordinands and fewer people chasing plenty of church posts. Schoolmastering was very much for the young before they got a decent living. So it's true that Nuneaton Grammar was subjected to the external pressures, royal decrees and episcopal instructions. But that doesn't seem to me to be any different to a parish church or the parish administration of a poor law, which also has to take account of extra parochial things. And enabling local boys from the modest, if not the poorest, backgrounds to receive a free education, and showing initiative in setting up the institution. I think at least one endowed grammar school deserves to take its place as a parish institution. Now, doubtless there are many other stories of school. The trouble is school history is always done individually, and often links and connections I've discovered in the 19th century are just missed. And more research in individual schools would surely help to develop our understanding of how far and when endowed schools were indeed parochial institutions. Thank you.
Well, time to ask a few questions. Can I ask the first, actually, something that seems to me most unusual for a school in this sort of period is the bequest of money for books for poor scholars. My impression is that normally in a school there might be a copy of a dictionary, something like that, that was for the schoolmaster and maybe the pupils to use, but the grammar books had to be paid for by the pupils themselves. Now, this seems an unusual request to actually help the pupils with the books that they were going to use.
Yes, the strange thing, because about the haphazard nature of records, there are some quite good financial records, as you see, for the 16th century, but for the early 17th, there's nothing. Now, with books, it's all the way around. That's the only reference to books until we've got a small list of books in 1607. The educational historian A.F. Leach put his nose up because one of them was a horn book, and he said, you don't have those in grammar schools. They're for elementary schools. But they clearly educate at a fairly elementary level as well. But it appears, perhaps, that some of the, maybe, one answer might be that some of the genuinely quite poor people, boys of Nuneaton, did go to the school. But I've said, I've written my book, in the book, which I've got some copies in the car if anybody wants one, I'm meant to bring one up. It's only £9.95. I think you've got to be wary of poor. I think poor possibly means not the wealthy gentry, and it's a blanket term, perhaps, applied to ordinary people. But clearly, there are some ordinary people are going to that school. And we may have underestimated. Obviously, the very poor, they go out to work and they don't learn anything. Mm. But I think we may have underestimated how modestly off people went to school at quite an early age. If it's haphazard, it's random, it's a lottery, if you go to school.
Just coming in, I mean, I thought that was a wonderful presentation, I really enjoyed that. Coming into what you were saying about the definition of the poor, I think you may well be right there. I think by poor they may just mean, you know, not the wealthy. I mean, speaking from my own personal experience, my great-great-great-grandfather got something signed by his local MP to say that his son was an object of charity. Well, there was no way he was. You know, his father was a yeoman farmer with estates in two villages, but, you know, the local MP signed he was an object of charity, and off he went to a charity school.
I think it's a question of where you draw the line. Mm. Take the grey area would be someone like John Rotherham, who looks to me, apart from Marmaduke Constable, to be the best off of the yeomen. He's quite well off. His daughter makes a good marriage with the Willoughbys, and he's on the up. He's on the rise. And young Willoughby goes off, is the first one from the school to go to Cambridge. And I suspect that they might go above the line. Mm. They wouldn't. They might be a little bit insulted by it, but I think we're in agreement that poor does go higher up than we think.
Yeah. I just wonder whether you discovered some sort of confessional flavour about this institution, whether there was a particular religious agenda at any stage of its development, maybe at the beginning, or maybe, you know, whether it's sort of up and down, or whether you think it's a sort of a neutral parochial school, which is really for the benefit of the community, as it were.
The evidence is tantalising little around that time. I even had to work out that some people said it was 1542 because the Chancery Commissioners had instructions to shut anything before more than 6 years. But they used the word about, and about, I've discovered, did not mean what we mean by about. Roughly, we say. About means more than. And I don't think it could have been 1542. It must have been 1540. I think it's more the pragmatic. That's my feeling, your second point. Because the Ethan Shagan theory, it's saying we don't like the way things are going. I mean, Nuneaton is a small place. There's Lollardy is quite strong in Coventry. And in the 17th century, Nuneaton is quite parliamentarian. And later on, you can identify schoolmasters as Puritan and Royalist and having definite views. At this stage, it's tantalising little. But I suspect there isn't a particular religious agenda. One of the things we're not sure about is who took services for this pluralist absentee vicar. I think it's more likely to be a pragmatic thing. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I, at a parish studies weekend, but it's not just that I'm at parish studies to please you. I think that probably is the answer.
could have been something, of course, like the death of a Chantry priest, Chantry priest who doubled up as schoolmaster.
Well,
and,
yes.
They felt that they would get better value for money if they actually paid someone primarily.
We have reference as late as 1525 to William Mollisdale, who's a Chantry priest. Mm-hmm. Because going back to your question, there are people like the Everards who are obviously very traditional Catholics in the wills and the obits and everything that they leave well into the 1520s, and Nuneaton seems quite a traditional Catholic place. But what we don't know about is the 1530s there. That's the difficulty. But yes, I think that they probably just felt things were going to be difficult.
Speaking as someone from Yorkshire who knows quite a few of these constables, off and on,
yes,
they did not tend towards the education. They tended far more towards buying masses.
Yeah,
there was a. I mean, you can't speak for every one of a family.
There's one that sits on the scholarship at St John's, I think.
Oh well, you see, that isn't in Yorkshire. I'm useless out of my own county.
The problem with Marmaduke Constable is his father was in the Pilgrimage of Grace, so that suggests Catholic. His son, though, suggests to me pragmatism, because he is one of the visitors to Nuneaton Priory. He works for Thomas Cromwell. It looks as if he's decided this is not the place to be, I'm coming over to the religious radicals, at least on the surface. And so, hey presto, gets his reward with the lands. So it looks as if he's played it right. I don't see religious principle there. Everyone is different, of course. I mean, up in Yorkshire, there's a more even the recusant there, is there?
Yeah, the constables tended to be on the recusant side, all the women of the family.
Yeah. It adds to my feeling that he hasn't got a lot to do with the setting up of the school. I don't think, although he's buried in Nuneaton, I don't think he was ever felt, other than that it was a source of income and he was desperate for money. Yeah. I don't think he's very interested.